Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with section 3 from Revelo Oliver's America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative, and we're in the chapter that or part that concerns his articles from the 50s and 60s. And we've done Spengler and Toynbee, and here in part 3 we'll see what he's talking about. Should be about average length, so let's dig in. Part 3. The social and political questions of our day are all primarily historical problems. To think about them rationally, we must begin by consulting the record of human experience in the past. And we soon realize that if only we knew enough about history and understood it, we should have the answers to all our questions. Unique events are always incomprehensible, and every change is unique until it has been repeated often enough to be recognized as forming some part of an intelligible pattern. We could not identify even so simple a sensation in our own bodies as hunger had we not experienced it 1,000 times and observed that a good meal invariably abolishes it for a while. No man lives long enough to behold with his own eyes a pattern of change in society. He is like the midge that is born in the afternoon and dies at sunset, and which, therefore, no matter how intelligent it might be, could never discover or even suspect that day and night come in regular alternation. Unlike the midge, however, man can consult the experience of the comparatively few generations of his species that have preceded him during the comparatively brief period of about 5,000 years in which human beings have had the power to leave records for the instruction of their posterity. That, unfortunately, is not enough history to give positive and indubitable answers to many of our questions, but it is all that we have. The historian today is often in the position of the Greek philosophers who tried to decide whether the solar system was geocentric or heliocentric, and could not reach a definite conclusion simply because there was not available in the world a record of sufficiently exact observations recorded over a sufficiently long period of time. The modern historian who tries to explain the rise and fall of civilizations may possibly find the right explanation. But if he does, and if he is really an historian, he knows that, at best, he is in the position of Aristarchus, who first systematized and formulated the heliocentric theory, the sun-centered, and who must have known that his theory could not be proved during his own lifetime or for many years to come, i.e., not until the annual parallax of at least one fixed star had been determined. This was first accomplished by Bessel in 1838, 3 centuries after Copernicus. What Aristarchus could not anticipate, of course, was that the level of civilization would so fluctuate that it would be 21 centuries before men could be certain that he had been right. The historiognomer, though aware that his hypothesis must remain an hypothesis in his time, can draw an analogy in terms of an historical certainty. When civilized mankind lost interest in the problem that Aristarchus tried to solve with his unverifiable theory, it was headed toward a dark age in which men forgot facts that had once been ascertained, an age so stultified that men forgot that they had once known that the earth was a globe, and so relapsed to the primitive notion that it was flat. In this little series of articles in American Opinion, of which the first was published in May and the second in June, I do not attempt to do more than describe briefly some recent efforts to formulate a general theory of historical causality. Why do things happen? Why do civilizations rise and fall? General theory of historical causality. Man and God. Among the new formulations, a very honorable place must be given to Eric Voegelin's Order in History, of which the first 3 volumes appeared in 1956-57. Baton Rouge, Louisiana State University Press, 542 plus 390 plus 384 pages. The announced plan of work calls for three more volumes, which will carry the analysis from the 4th century BC on to the present. I hear that Volume 4 may be published before the end of 1964. Dr. Voegelin, V-O-E-G-E-L-I-N, writes inductively. He reviews historical development, not in the manner of a Spengler to illustrate and substantiate an enunciated theory, but to elicit the theory step by step from the historical changes that he reviews. Let the theory emanate from the examples. His philosophy of history differs radically from all other recent formulations. It may prove to be comparable to St. Augustine's. It certainly is essentially Platonic. At least I am sure that Dr. Voegelin's work will not appeal to anyone who shares Edward Lucas Wright's, or White's, regret that the Platonic writing survived, while the works of, quote, the great philosophers, such as Democritus, perished. But it is scarcely possible to infer the whole of Professor Voegelin's historical conception from the parts of his work thus far published. He has not yet come to the three points that will most severely test the validity of his hypothesis: the origin of Christianity, the fall of the Roman Empire, and the Renaissance. To attempt to predict how he will explain those historical climacterics in his theory would be no less foolish than presumptuous. What is certain, in the meantime, is that order in history is the work of a first-rate mind, and that what has been published deserves very serious study. Dr. Voegelin, unlike Spengler and most authors of cyclic theories, regards Western civilization as a unity from Homer to the present, subject, indeed, to fluctuations of ascent and decline, but with no break in its continuity. Though the difference may have been only potentially present in its origins, Western civilization early became generically different from the Oriental civilizations of what Voegelin calls the cosmological empires, and defines by an analysis of the Egyptian and Sumero-Akkadian cultures. The generic difference was the result of a quote-unquote leap toward a higher order of being in which men became truly conscious of their identity as individuals and, at the same time, of their participation as individuals in a moral order willed by God. It is this leap which makes history, in the fullest sense of the word, possible. The world of the cosmological myth is essentially a timeless world, for while it may be convulsed by catastrophes such as wars, massacres, and plagues, men, scarcely conscious of their own spiritual individuality, can conceive of only one world order, that of their monarch God. Men are, as the Egyptian phrase had it, the cattle of God. But, with the, quote, leap in being, the epical event that breaks the compactness of the early cosmological myth and establishes the order of man in his immediacy under God, men can conceive of a real future, for they have a purpose toward which they are working in conformity with the divine will. In a preliminary volume which bears the subtitle Israel and Revelation, Dr. Voegelin seeks to define the leap in being by means of a long analysis of the Hebrew prophets, in which he is concerned only with showing the epical significance of their conception, familiar to everyone from the Old Testament, of man's relation to God. In the second volume, the author goes back to the time of Homer and traces the development of the concept of social order through the maturity of the Greek polis and the Peloponnesian War. The third volume is Plato and Aristotle, much Plato and little Aristotle. The adequacy of the general theory that Dr. Voegelin is developing through these volumes remains to be tested. He has undertaken the formidable task of trying to incorporate in an historical analysis, which must be philosophically objective, the transcendental values that are, for most people, matters of faith. But he has, at the very least, demonstrated the clear and vast difference between the transcendental perception, however it is stated, and a grotesque phenomenon with which it is often confused by superficial writers, the perverse will to believe what is contrary to manifest reality. To designate that mental perversion more specifically, he coins the correct and useful word metastatic. Quote, the metastatic will to transform reality by means of eschatological, mythical, or historiographic fantasy, or by perverting faith into an instrument of pragmatic action, is a sinister force that runs through history from the Gnostic Hellenes to the liberal intellectuals, quote-unquote, of today. But although common sense in weak minds can be drugged with verbiage, they can be fooled by words, reality cannot be changed by a lie. In religious terms, the will to transform reality into something which, by essence, it is not, is rebellion against the nature of things as ordained by God, and must never be confused with religion. In human terms, it is a revolt against reason, a war upon sanity waged by frenetic, quote-unquote, intellectuals. Dr. Voegelin is indisputably right when he says that metastatic faith is one of the great sources of disorder, if not the principal one, in the contemporary world, and it is a matter of life and death for all of us to understand the phenomenon and to find remedies against it before it destroys us. All of that a quote. Never the twain shall meet. Far more modest in size and limited in scope is the last book written by the late William S. Haas, H-A-A-S, The Destiny of the Mind, East and West. New York, Macmillan, 319 pages. Professor Haas does not attempt to formulate or even suggest a philosophy of history, but he does isolate and identify a phenomenon that will have to be taken into account in formulating a valid theory of history. Professor Haas attacks, and I believe demolishes, an assumption that underlies almost all modern theories of history, that the minds of human beings, if not defective or disordered, work in essentially the same way. He demolishes that theory. I suspect that Haas's work will instantly convince every Westerner who has made a really intensive study of an Oriental culture. He will find in the book a sudden clarification of his own disconcerting experience. Reading it, he, like the heroine of one of Edith Wharton's best stories, quote, will say, long after, that was it. Reminds you of Pierce's saying that you can't get it think the way other races do. They think too differently. I should suppose that no one begins serious study of an Oriental culture without a certain romantic enthusiasm, for nothing less is required to surmount the very formidable linguistic barriers. It takes a long time to surmount them, and during that time, the student's studies seem to bring him ever nearer to a fundamental unity of mankind underlying the diversity of regional cultures. But when language has ceased to be an obstacle, there inevitably comes, sooner or later, a day when the student has to admit to himself that the more he learns, the less he understands. He is confronted by minds whose operations he can glimpse from time to time, but he cannot follow. He realizes, for example, that to the Hindu mind it simply does not matter whether George Washington lived earlier than Christopher Columbus or later. And then he realizes that he cannot himself really understand how it is possible to think about events without considering the sequence in which they occurred. While pondering that enigma, he will perceive that he has been translating Hindu doctrines into terms of Western thought, assuming that each proposition has logical antecedents or consequences of which there is usually no trace in the original texts. And so he comes to suspect that his understanding of a specific doctrine, such as Vedantic Karman or the Buddhistic Skandhas, is no more a reproduction of what the doctrine means to a Hindu mind than Puccini's Madame Butterfly is a reproduction of life in Japan. He can learn a great deal about such doctrines, to be sure, but only so long as he remembers that he is an observer, standing outside a barrier that he can never cross. Professor Haas went through this common experience, but he resolved to ascertain precisely what the barrier was. In the book that he wrote, as the conclusion of many years of study, he identifies and by copious illustration demonstrates the existence of two generically different mentalities. The Occidental mind, which appears fully formed in the earliest Greek philosophers and has not since changed, is the mind of conceptual thought, of thought directed from the mind toward an object. So completely are we dominated by this mentality that the only way in which we can think about ourselves is by placing ourselves momentarily in the position of an outside observer looking at us. We must try, as best we can, to make an objective study of ourselves. The Oriental mind, which appears fully formed in the earliest Upanishads, does not think conceptually. Its thought is never directed away from itself. The Oriental mind cannot separate what it is thinking about from itself. The capacity for objective thought is peculiar to the philosophical mind of the West. The capacity for objective thought is peculiar to the West. For the Oriental mental configuration, Haas coins the term philousian, philousian. Philousian. One consequence of this distinction is that there is and can be no Oriental philosophy, for when we apply the word philosophy to an Oriental doctrine, we misrepresent it, as grossly as though we were to call a woman's intuition logic. It also follows that there is no Oriental mysticism. Mysticism is a term by which the philosophical mind designates what is, for it, a leap over the logical steps of conceptual thinking. The term, therefore, misrepresents a mental process which is not conceptual and in which, therefore, there can be no leap. The Western mind simply cannot understand the Eastern mind without disowning itself. And not even then, unless it destroys its own capacity for the only kind of thinking that it recognizes as rational. Professor Haas, as a conscientious scholar, warns us that his conclusions regarding the Orient are based on his own observation in the two fields in which he is specially competent. Thus, he is primarily concerned with India and secondarily with China. The use of India as the primary source of data greatly simplifies the problem. It shows that the difference in mentality cannot be a result of linguistic structure and suggests that it may not be racial. When we study a language of radically different grammatical structure and basic metaphors, such as Hebrew or Japanese, we realize that persons who think in these languages must do so in a way that seems very strange to us, though not necessarily by a different process. But Sanskrit, with its derivative Pali, is an Indo-European language. Although it is more complicated, it does not differ from English or German or Greek in its basic way of expressing thoughts. And if the philousian mentality appears in the Upanishads, it is noteworthy that most students are inclined to believe that the earliest of these mystic rhapsodies were written before the Aryan blood was absorbed in the teeming masses of the polyphyletic India, which would make it seem likely that the authors were Aryans themselves. Professor Haas's analysis may need to be refined or elaborated, and it is entirely impossible that there are more than two kinds of thinking. But by showing that there is a difference so fundamental, a difference more elemental and deeper than Spengler's idées, maîtresses, the author has, I believe, done for the study of comparative history what Bohr, B, O with the umlaut, H-R, did for atomic physics, usually Niels Bohr, would be pronounced normally. Although Professor Haas has, in his concluding chapter, reveals a certain pessimism, as though he shared the fashionable view that our only future is liquidation, he and Professor Vogelin agree in regarding the unique civilization of the West as a unity, a single continuity that runs, with fluctuations but no break, from the ancient Greeks to ourselves. How crucial this conception may be is seen from two books to which I now turn, which deny such a continuity. Whether the West and the Greek Rome are the same thing, Spengler said no, and others say yes. Next subtitle, The Mood of Empire. The Mood of Empire. About a decade ago, students of history began to hear of a great new formulation of historical perspectives, admittedly based on Spengler, but extending and revising the Spenglerian analysis. It was the work of an unknown American, rumored to have been an officer of our diplomatic service, who wrote in Ireland under the strange pseudonym of Ulrich Virang. It had been published by an obscure house in London in 1948, but it was virtually unprocurable. Book dealers despaired of finding a copy. When I finally obtained one, it cost me, unbound, well over $100, and I have been told of a man who paid $300 for his. The book was at last reprinted in New York in 1962 in an edition that was quickly sold out. A new edition, handsomely printed from the same plates, is now available. Imperium, the Philosophy of History and Politics, Sausalito, California, the Noontide Press, 666 pages, and we've done the audiobook on that. See bnnforum.com. It is now known that Ulick Verang was not, as first rumored, a diplomat. His real name was Francis Parker Yockey, Y-O-C-K-E-Y, and he was an American lawyer, author of a still unpublished work on constitutional law. Born in Chicago in 1917, he was a county attorney in Michigan when he was recruited for a service on the legal staff of the quote-unquote trials that the American conquerors staged in Germany as an obscene prelude to the lynchings at Nuremberg. See on this subject F.J.P. Veal, V-E-A-L-E, Advanced to Barbarism, Devon-Adair, New York, and Captain Russell Grenfell, Unconditional Hatred, Devon-Adair. Yockey, who appears to have entertained some illusions when he accepted the position, was disillusioned when he worked in Germany, probably by the spectacle provided by the sadist in American uniform who inflicted unspeakable tortures on helpless German prisoners to extort perjured testimony at the trials. Trials in quotes, because they were fake. The American judge, Edward L. Van Roden, who was a member of the Official Commission of Inquiry, reported that in 137 of the 139 cases that he investigated, the victim had been sexually maimed for life. Had Yockey been willing to become an accomplice in those crimes, he could probably have risen to membership in the Warren Gang, but instead of being a good quote-unquote liberal, he resigned. In 1947, he settled down in Ireland and wrote Imperium. He was, I believe, the youngest man who has undertaken to formulate a sino-heretical philosophy of history. He was only 31 when he completed it, and it is not remarkable that his book bears traces of the shock and bitter disillusion that he had experienced in Germany. After his book was published, he appears to have been subjected to persecution by, quote-unquote, our State Department, which somehow managed to confiscate his passport, and he is said to have had to go underground to dodge assassins. He was arrested in San Francisco in June 1960, held under a preposterously high bail that his sister and friends could not raise at once, and so kept in jail until his body could conveniently be discovered as that of a quote-unquote suicide. Yockey's tragic career, which I have mentioned briefly because it explains some elements in his book, will naturally awaken sympathy in every generous heart, but we must judge his work as dispassionately and objectively as though it had been written, as most works of its kind are, by an unperturbed scholar in the tranquility of his study. Writing in a small Irish town with few or no books at his disposal, the author made quite a number of unfortunate errors in his reporting of history. He says, for example, that after 1267, quote, Germany disappeared from Western history as a unit of political significance for 500 years. During those centuries, the high history of Europe was made by other powers, mostly with their own blood. This meant that, in comparison with the others, Germany was spared. When he wrote that, of course, Yockey had simply forgotten the Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648, in which, according to the best estimates of cautious historians, two-thirds of the population of Germany perished, a war far more bloody and disastrous than any more recent conflict. That is the most obvious blunder in the book, but there are at least a dozen more that are only a little less serious. But Yockey's major conclusion is substantially that which emerges from every honest and discerning attempt to construct a philosophy of history, although it is sometimes stated less clearly or with more reservations. And that conclusion is the fundamental unity of the West today. As against the rest of the world, the West is a political unity, since the differences between Germany, Italy, France, Britain, and ourselves are, like the differences between Maine, Virginia, Wyoming, and California, relatively negligible, and necessarily negligible when the survival of the whole is at stake. Furthermore, the culture of the West, like every viable civilization, is a unity in the sense that its parts are organically interdependent. Although architecture, music, literature, the mimetic arts, science, economics, and religion may seem at first glance more or less unrelated, they are all constituent parts of the cultural whole, and the disease of any one will sooner or later affect all the others. Your hands will not long retain their strength if there is gangrene in the foot or cancer in the stomach. Now, unless history has been written in vain and the human mind is impotent, that proposition is a fundamental truth. And Yaki expresses it so persuasively and even eloquently that it lends cogency to the whole of his argument. His book, therefore, can be dangerous if you accept it without a full awareness of its implications. There are two of these that you should note with special care. Yaki follows Spencer in treating the West as a separate civilization that came into being about the time of Charlemagne and therefore has no continuity or generic relationship, generic relationship with the classical. The consequences of that proposition may be most conveniently examined when we discuss below the book by Mr. Brown. Yaki also follows Spengler in the paradox to which I called attention in my first article. He discounts the importance of and even in large part denies the reality of biological heredity and hence of races. So Spengler and Yaki both de-emphasize or even ignore race. But he regards a civilization, which thus becomes entirely a body of mental concepts, as a quasi-biological organism subject to quasi-biological laws. Yaki goes even further than Spengler in applying this doctrine that a civilization is a conceptual organism which, by its very nature, has an inherent destiny that it must fulfill or perish, just as an acorn has undoubtedly within it a destiny which requires that it grow to be an oak tree or die. If the acorn were conscious, it could not by any effort become a palm tree or a cabbage. Now Yaki, for Yaki, and this is the central point that you must bear in mind to understand him, that destiny inherent in the structure of a civilization must take precedence over all other considerations, and therefore is in itself the highest morality. To take an extreme case, if a tiger came to believe that it was immoral to shed blood, it would starve and so commit suicide, the most immoral act of all. It is true that every society, not actually moribund, receives its own survival as a moral imperative. We all recognize that there are few moral greatnesses greater than that of the soldier who lays down his life for his country. And when we hear a pacifist squawking in fear lest something damage a hide whose value is perceptible to no one but himself, we feel contempt for the little creature, not so much because he is a coward, as because he, like the sneak thief, is dishonestly trying to evade the responsibilities of participation in a society which he wants to exploit for his own comfort. The little wretch is simply immoral. That's what makes his pretenses so disgusting. But the doctrine with which we are here concerned extends the principle of survival far beyond that point. Yaki, following the renowned historian Mommsen, M-O-M-M-S-E-N, describes Cicero and the younger Cato as culture-retarding weaklings. Yaki must have been a little influenced by Mommsen's prestige, but he is thinking primarily in terms of his own historical reasoning, viz., that the triumph of Caesar was not merely inevitable, but right, because it was historically necessary for the preservation and expansion of Rome. If you believe, as I do, that the Roman Republic could have been preserved had enough of its ruling classes had the wisdom and patriotism to follow Cicero and Cato, or even if you grant that Cicero and Cato were fighting for a lost cause, you will probably resent Yaki's characterization, which disparages highly cultivated men of great moral probity, and by implication exalts above them scoundrels such as Curio, who, after squandering his own fortune, was secretly financed by Caesar and posed in public as a staunch and devoted conservative. thus gaining a political position which he used surreptitiously to sabotage the conservative cause and eventually to betray it into the hands of its enemies. You and I may feel that Curio was despicable. Yaki, without praising Curio, will insist that Cicero and Cato were far worse because they, by their influence, wasted Roman lives and resources on a hopeless effort to impede the inevitable. Now we could argue that their cause was not hopeless, and we could show that Caesar was repeatedly saved from defeat by the mistakes of his enemy, ranging from their gullible willingness to trust and elect to office the great conservative Curio, to inept strategy at the Battle of Pharsalus. But we should not persuade Yaki, who would reply that the defeat of Caesar would have meant, at most, a delay of a few years, that the very possibility of the civil war was in itself proof that the Roman state had reached the point at which such instruments of corruption as elections and political parties must be effectively superseded by authoritarian rule if the state is to survive at all. Now, Yaki applies the same principles to the United States today. Our efforts to restore and preserve the Republic are futile because the United States, like Rome, has reached a stage of such irreversible moral decay that the only form of government now possible for us is an authoritarian one. And that means a government with power to control economic life. In this, Yaki seems at first sight to agree with our quote-unquote liberals who are working so industriously for a totalitarian dictatorship. The difference is that Yaki does not want a government that will be authoritarian merely to deliver us to the savages. He wants a Caesar who will represent America and the West, not a sneaking hireling of our enemies. Obviously, our problem in historical theory has by now become an extremely urgent and practical one, and it is not a coincidence that it corresponds to the only really serious intellectual disagreement among American conservatives today. This disagreement has come farthest into the open, and hence may be most clearly be seen in some of the attacks by really intelligent and well-informed American conservatives on the John Birch Society. If you will examine carefully the premises implicit in the intellectually serious criticism, you find that the critic, whether he chooses to describe Mr. Robert Welch as extreme or timid, is really speaking from a position that is, for all practical purposes, Yaki's. I do not imply that all critics are as brilliant as Yaki or have thought through their position as carefully, nor am I unaware that there is some bitter disagreement among them. They agree that we must fight and defeat the International Communist Conspiracy, capital ICC, although it may be better strategy at the present time to pretend that it doesn't exist or, on the other hand, to give it some other name, but to fight for less government is foolish and, yes, immoral. For one thing, the nation has become too corrupt and demoralized. For another, we shall need the utmost powers of government to enforce morality and cut out the rot. Opposition to centralized government is an attempt to attain the impossible, which would be harmful if it could be obtained. Americans must strive by any and all means, for the end will justify them, to capture the highly centralized government that the liberals and communists have built up. Capture it and then use it ruthlessly for the benefit of Americans. It would be bad strategy to come right out and say that, but verbum sat sapiente. And there you have the real intellectual that divides Americans today. We are either Ciceronians or Caesarians. Either we want to use a strong central government or we want to try to preserve the old dying good stuff that we used to have. And then there's a footnote there. We got a few more pages of part 3. 1. Since these articles are reprinted as part of the historical record, I have let stand this and other references to the Birch business, of which I am now heartily ashamed. Remember, he later left it, realizing it was a front and that someone was funding Welch. Since they show me to have been, during at least part of the time that I labored for it, the dupe of a clever promoter. Oliver on himself. Given the professed purposes of the society, which corresponded to the purposes that Welch had professed to me in 1958, and which in 1963 I still believed to be genuine, The distinction drawn in this paragraph is valid, although it is now of only historical significance. If we still had a choice in 1963, as I then optimistically hoped, the opportunity to make such a choice is now gone forever. The Ciceronian position is no less valid as a statement of what is desirable, but to imagine that it is still feasible is to indulge in the charming but dangerous romanticism of laudatores temporis acti. To be sure, we can still dream that if our race and civilization survive and become again viable, our remote descendants centuries hence may be able to afford the luxury of a constitutionally limited government after they have destroyed or effectively reduced to impotence our racial enemies. Next subtitle, The Drunken Giant. Drunken Giant. The most recent formulation of A Philosophy of History is a brilliant book by Lawrence R. Brown, The Might of the West, Ivan Obolensky, New York, 562 pages. The author is an American engineer and mathematician, Lawrence R. Brown, who evidently undertook a study of history to ascertain why the U.S. and the West are committing suicide. So far as I can tell from a careful reading of the text, there is no indication that Mr. Brown has read Yaki or even heard of him. It is significant, therefore, that he has reached, by an entirely different route, what are substantially the same conclusions. Mr. Brown has read Spengler, to whom he owes a great deal, but he has dropped the greater part of Spengler's conception of an organism with a fixed lifespan. In this respect, Mr. Brown's philosophy is one of the most optimistic. Far from being doomed by some inherent or external destiny, we of the West, if only we come to our senses, may be just beginning the great age of our civilization. The author has made a survey of other civilizations, including the Egyptian, Babylonian, Hindu, and Chinese, covering both their political history and culture, with the exception of literature, which appears not to interest him. For Spengler's Magian civilization, that's the Arabs and Muslims, he substitutes a Levantine culture, which he describes and analyzes without Spengler's need to force it into the same pattern as other civilizations, and many readers will feel, as I do, that this description is both more illuminating and more nearly right than Spengler's. The historical reporting is not infallible, of course, and Mr. Brown slips more than once, particularly when engaged in demonstrating a total and absolute division between classical antiquity and the modern West. He permits himself to be carried away by polemical ardor. The charitable reader will simply overlook the comparison between India and Greece on page 121. Mr. Brown knows very well that the Parthenon is not built of wood, that Athens was a thalassocracy, and that the plays of Aeschylus were written down before the time of Marcus Aurelius. He just forgot all that in a moment of zeal. For Mr. Brown, the great proof of the generic cultural difference is the failure of the classical world to develop a technology comparable to our own. This, I grant, is a real problem. I think, however, that the author could profit from reconsideration of many points in his argument. He mentions, for example, the development of cannon, and that is important. As everyone knows, and has recently seen demonstrated by such developments as radar, atomic fusion, and guided missiles, the necessities of war are the mother of invention, and all of the major technical advances are the direct or indirect results of military need. The need to cast bigger and better cannon created the metallurgical skill without which most subsequent machines of any kind would have been impossible. Now, one reason why the modern world developed the cannon and the ancient world did not may be the fact that the Western world had lost the art of building the great torsion artillery of Hellenistic times, which was superior in both hitting power and rate of fire to any cannon that Europe was able to produce for two centuries after cannon were first introduced. See Erwin Schramm, Die antiken Geschütze der Salzburg, Berlin, 1918. Mr. Brown makes a strong case, stronger, I should say, than Spengler's, for the independence of European civilization. He is eminently right in making the principal criterion the great technology and the scientific method that are the true glory and the unique creation of our civilization. and alien to all others. Our civilization, on this showing, was born in the time of Charlemagne, and it went through the process that Spengler calls pseudomorphosis, by which a young people emerging from barbarism takes over some of the outward forms and the learning of a more advanced civilization. We took over a very little from the classical and much from the Levantine world that was represented by both Byzantium and Islam, but we failed, at the time and ever since, to eliminate the alien elements after they had served their dolorous fate to be, quote, a society whose inward convictions have been at hopeless variance with its outward professions. Mr. Brown proves that the dominant mentality of the West appears in St. Anselm. He rightly emphasizes the great intellectual activity of the scholastics, and his disquisition on the emergence of real scientific inquiry among them will astonish, I dare say, all but the very few of our contemporaries who take the trouble to read the most uninviting of all the uninviting texts in the medieval Latin. Mr. Brown is further right in emphasizing, as too few writers on the subject have done, that one great cause of weakness and decay, and one that seems to have had more baneful effects on our own culture than on any other, is the sheer unwillingness of the children, the loutish and the selfish, to bear the responsibilities and the burden of a high civilization. On this point, it is always instructive to read Corea Moylan Walsh. But Mr. Brown's absolute dichotomy between classical and Western has consequences. If one accepts it, one must follow him in seeing the Renaissance and Reformation as two manifestations of the same retreat from the exacting moral and intellectual responsibilities of Western civilization. And we must further follow him in the sweeping generalization that, quote, 18th century liberalism was in fact the direct intellectual and moral ancestor of modern leftism. Close quote. This statement does not mean that Mr. Brown is thinking only of the obvious fact that there must have been some fatal mental flaw in an age that could tolerate such mountebanks as Cagliostro, or take seriously a half-educated, half-crazed chatterer like Rousseau. He has not forgotten such writers as Montesquieu, whom Émile Faguet, for example, identifies as the real liberal and the very opposite of Rousseau, whom Faguet classifies as a democrat. Mr. Brown thinks that the difference doesn't matter. This will suggest the amount of pseudomorphosis that we must find in Western culture if we are to accept Mr. Brown's philosophical view. It is simply enormous. Let us grant that Christianity is a Levantine and alien doctrine, except insofar as it was changed by Western thought and became the symbol of the unity of the West. Religion is, in many ways, a peculiar and anomalous force in history, and there are many proofs that a religion can somehow cross cultural frontiers. The cultures of China and India differ profoundly, but Buddhism was not only accepted in China, but also survived there as a major religion long after it had virtually disappeared in the land of its birth. And if we grant that Christianity was such a religion, we can further grant that it made possible the intrusion into the West and the persistence of other alien elements from the Levant, Judaism, that is. But what, on this hypothesis, shall we say of humanism? From the end of the 15th century to about the beginning of the 20th, our civilization so identified itself with the Greco-Roman that it devoted the greater part of the youth of every educated man to the extremely difficult and even painful task of so mastering the modalities of classical thought that he could think directly in Latin and Greek and so compose both prose and verse in those languages in conformity with the purest models and the most exacting standards. For that vast expenditure of human energy, there is no analogy in recorded history. And if that was pseudo-morphosis, what accounts for so great and continuous an hallucination? It was surely not the result of Levantine influence, for the classical is in most ways the antithesis of Levantine culture. Although the humanistic schools were usually church schools in both Catholic and Protestant countries, the humanistic education was certainly not necessary for religious purposes, and, as a matter of fact, there were always groups of vociferous fanatics who claimed that it was anti-religious. nor was that education needed for the development of Western science and technology. If anything, it impeded that development by diverting so much mental energy into its own channels. Learning or Latin and Greek instead of religion or science, technology. Why the West did it is clear. Apart from literary beauty, and apart from the profound historical analysis that one learns from Thucydides and Tacitus, the modern world sought in the ancient a system of civil ethics and of political life. This is how you live, and how you live together. Cicero was admired for his eloquence, but also for his vision of and devotion to the Republic. And, as Mr. Brown is aware, it was the Greco-Roman conception of the mixed constitution, Cicero, Polybius, Aristotle, that ultimately produced the American Constitution. So that too is pseudomorphosis. To put it a little more bluntly, on the basis of this analysis, not only democracy, whatever you mean by that, but all notions of representative government or republic such as ours was designed to be, are alien importations that the West has, through a gross misunderstanding of itself, permitted to pervert its nature. The true form of Western government must be found in a stable hierarchical system based on personal loyalties, either the feudal system at its best or the national monarchies of the 17th century. Last segment of three now. Repeating history. I have neither space nor inclination here to debate the conclusions reached by minds of indubitable power and integrity. No subsidiary of the Council on Foreign Relations hovered round Mr. Brown with $200,000 checks to subsidize his study of history, as with Toynbee. Nor have Time, the New York Times, and the other piffle peddlers burst into ecstasy over his book. Indeed, it seems likely that this article will be the first mention of his book in any periodical of national circulation. I merely call your attention to the logically necessary conclusions that follow from an analysis of Western civilization that would have seemed fantastic before the First World War, but seems quite cogent to some vigorous and independent minds today. That analysis, furthermore, is one that respects and even exalts the great technology that is the unique creation of the West and must be recognized as such by any rational philosophy of history. Our technology is so obviously the source of our power that, until quite recently, it was spared by the nihilists who have been openly engaged for the past 50 years in perverting and defiling our literature, music, painting, religion, ethics, and virtually every other major part of our culture. And the campaign, now begun, to subvert and paralyze Western science is still clandestine and masked by professed eagerness to, quote, finance vital research or to, quote, modernize outmoded mathematics. For many of our disinherited contemporaries, the physical and biological sciences appear to be the only intellectually serious and viable element in our civilization. Minds of native power, therefore, when they outgrow the sordid fairy tales told by liberals and see what crude superstitions masquerade as social science, most easily and naturally come to the historical analysis set forth by Mr. Brown. I'll venture a brief speculation about the future. As I write, the communist conspiracy is trying to force through the Senate a treasonable treaty that is unmistakably a preliminary to actual occupation and liquidation of the United States, and there are many other indications that the international criminals are making frenzied efforts to disarm and destroy us within the next year or two. If the conspiracy succeeds in demolishing the United States, then, in all probability, Western civilization will have come to an end. Let us suppose, however, that the communist conspiracy is thwarted. The principal force now opposing it is the body of Americans who are working both to defeat the conspiracy and to restore our republic of limited and divided powers. It is possible, of course, that they will succeed in the first, but fail in the second purpose. Let us suppose that they do. In that event, taking into account the present level of education, our obvious dependence on technology, the complex of countervailing political ambitions directed in one way or another toward exploitation of the state, the instinct for survival that is strong in all healthy men, and the movement of contemporary thought that may be discerned beneath the surface in many serious writings, although it is explicit or even intimated in but very few, taking all this into account, I think it likely that, as sometimes happens in history, even if Mr. Yockey and Mr. Brown are entirely wrong in their analysis, the future will make them right. In that event, if we have a future, it will belong to Caesar, as the strong man. And that's how section 3 ends. Look at Yockey and Brown, among others. And so there's one more section in this, which is part 4, which we'll get to next. So thanks for being with me today. Again, I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record as part of our Learning College at vnnforum.com. I'll be back with you again real soon.